clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes, and with me, as always, is Ty Libby.
Hey, Andy, it's been too long.
It's been too long. You're right. We are off last week. Just life gets busy, work gets busy, but we're back. I'm sure. You know, our millions of listeners were I was getting hit up. They're wondering, where were we? You know, Hank Haney texted me. He said, where's your podcast? But
we had to go play a couple of private courses.
Yeah.
Get some subject material.
Yes. We did a rare thing for us as the golf practice, and that we actually went and played a round of golf together. We went on a field trip.
Full 18 holes.
Full 18 holes to a private golf course, Westmoreland Country Club in Wilmette, Illinois. It was a fantastic time. And so today we're going to maybe give a field trip recap, round recap. And with us is the godfather of golf, Peter Donahue, and Jansen Mizorak, the Jansen of the Jansen Project, are with us. So guys, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Andy. It's always nice to be with you.
It's great to have you back, Pete, and Jansen. So let's set the scene. We went, it was maybe a 50-degree day on a Tuesday. We were one of the only groups out on the course. I think I saw one other twosome playing the course. It was completely empty other than our two groups of people. There were eight of us, and it was just a fantastic
day. We walked 18 holes.
We walked 18 holes. Yeah, no golf.
Beautiful fall colors in the trees.
Mm-hmm. Jansen. Do you have any impressions of the course and of our day together?
So that was my first time at Westmoreland, and that's been a course on my bucket list for a while. Just since moving up here, living in Evanston, I drive by it almost every single day, or a majority of the time up to work. So I get a little glimpse between the hedges and the tree line.
I've been working in Highland Park on and off for the past 10 years and have always been driving past. You can drive on Golf Road, and like you said, there's a little glimpse of the hedges of this golf course that always seems to be empty.
Right.
And it makes me sad because I know I'm driving 30 minutes further north to play a course that's
packed.
Busy and not as nice. And it was like a moment of liberation to finally get on the other side of the fence and be able to play there.
Yeah, when I got the text or just knew that we were going to get to go out there and play, I didn't sleep much the night before.
Wow.
I was pretty pumped up. The course was fantastic. I thought I was very impressed with the golf course from tee to green. I thought that there were some risk rewards to be had off the tee. But some really great visuals off the tee of the way that they've bunkered, have the bunkers placed. There's a lot of bunkers where you know you can carry them, but there's always one that's out there that's going to challenge you to where you have to shape a shot. So visually, I thought it was fantastic off the tee, but even more impressive around the greens with some of the approaches and the green complexes. I had fun just, you know, when I had some extra time to hit some putts on the fringe. Just because of the tight lies they had around there. Oh my goodness. It was like, I think the fringe was running or stimping at probably a 10, 9 or 10, which was cool. So, but yeah, very impressed. It was a great day.
Yeah, it was. And Peter, you and I actually played the day before at Pine Meadow, and I've played with you a few times now. And so when I got to the first tee on Tuesday at Westmoreland, I was a little bit confused because I saw what appeared to be a stranger swinging from the right side of the golf ball, swinging right-handed. And I checked, and it was you. So I'm sure many of our listeners don't know that you play golf both right and left-handed.
Yeah, I played golf all my life right-handed, but when I got into my mid-50s, the brakes on my swing started to fail, and the muscles in the right side of my chest and my hip were in pain all the time. And so I I started to get a notion as I looked to the future that perhaps my future in the game was as a left-handed golfer. So I have been questing at it, sometimes very diligently and sometimes not so diligently, for more than a decade. And I used to be better than I am today. About a couple of years ago, I started to feel better right-handed, so I was kind of hooked by the notion of maybe today I'll be better than I've ever been in my whole life, and I'm afraid that I take that as to be I'm better right-handed than I am left-handed. So, yes, we played at Pine Meadow and had a great day. And I didn't play very well. And when I went out to the next day to Westmoreland, I said, "Bill, you know, we're going to play a team game." I was excited. I don't play much competitive golf anymore. So to me, that felt like a competitive round, and I wanted to play as good as I could play. So I pulled righty out, and that's the fourth round I played right-handed this year, and it was a thrill. It was thrilling for me. And the golf course itself, I played that golf course when I was in my late 20s for the first time, and that was 40 years ago. So they have done a lot of significant makeover since then. And as Jansen alluded to, the flat bunkers with the raised bermed up fronts is a terrific look. And and it's a very, you know, they defend par with those bunkers. It's not a very long golf course, but it looks really cool, and it's really, really tight in places.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I was impressed by was the elevation changes. You know, Chicago and the greater Chicagoland area being so flat, this course actually had some up and downs that were fun to look at. I think we had a blind tee shot at one point. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah. And that little hole, that seventh hole, that blind tee shot, that is an insecure feeling. You know, you can see that there's danger in the trees right and left, and the look of that hill sloping, you know, in each direction gives you the impression you're hitting at a turtle back out there in the blankness. And I agree with you. I didn't remember those elevation changes, but the club sits on a hill. And they make great use of that hill, don't they? I mean, there must have been a half a dozen or holes that use that hill.
The courses we tend to play tend to be flat for the most part. But, yeah, I was really impressed by the elevation changes. And as you guys mentioned, the fairway bunkers are tough. Those are probably the toughest fairway bunkers I've seen, at least recent history.
Chris Olerking was with us, and he almost was saying the fairway bunkers he thought were potentially unfair, because if you hit in a fairway bunker, you can't hit towards the green. It's the lips are so steep that you won't be able to reach the green from the fairway bunker. And I don't know. I'm not a golf course architect. I don't know why they make decisions they make, but I think I agree with him.
I would have to agree with him, because on the last hole, for example, I hit a fairway bunker on number 18. Actually, Chris and I hit the same one, and that was the first one I was in all day, and it definitely defended par, as Pete was saying. If you were in one of those, the best really you could make was probably bogey, unless you were going to get up and down from 60 yards or 100 yards. But, you know, from what I've heard, that course, that when they redid some of the bunkering, I heard that they put more fescue up on the banks of them and on the lips. And so obviously we played it and the course is going into a dormant state. And so it looked like some of it had been cut down, but I can only imagine how much more challenging they are, being thin, narrow, deep, and having fescue guarding the lips. So I think it's safe to say it might be a little unfair.
Well, I think that it's definitely challenging, and it's a point of view, you know, and that point of view being, that, hey, we don't have a golf course that's going to kill you with length, but you better be strategic in what you're doing, because this is, you know, on the old kids' board game Candyland, that is the molasses swamp when you get into those bunkers. And it's challenging. I think that it's a point of view. I admire it, and I love the experience.
Yeah, I've maybe only played two or three other private courses in my life, and that was the first time it wasn't part of a college tournament or on like a caddy day. So it was fun to be there, be with some friends and good people. I enjoyed walking a lot. Yeah. After that round, I am 100% a proponent of walking and playing golf. I found that the conversation finds a way to sustain itself throughout the whole 18 holes, where if you're just riding in a golf cart, you talk with the person you're with, and really you don't really talk to other people in your group because there's not that much time walking, you know, from your ball to the green or whatever. But this time with all four of you, there's more camaraderie. You're able to hear different perspectives, hear different stories.
I completely agree. I actually mentioned to Chris during the round, I think we were on hole 13 or 14, and we were walking down the fairway, and I saw the group ahead of us, which Pete, Mike, Tina, and Josh were in. And it was cool to just watch us hoof it and do what our students do day in and day out. Our students, especially the players in high school, they aren't allowed to ride in carts. And so they have to be conditioned to be able to carry their bag for a minimum of 9 holes for some of their matches. But you get into regional, state, sectionals, all of those competitive times of the year, and they're hoofing it, you know, back-to-back days or 36 holes in one day. And so that's part of the game you almost kind of forget about until you have to do it, and you start to feel your calves and your shoulders burning a little bit. But it was kind of eye-opening to see that all the coaches hoofing the bag just like the students do. You know, we were kind of back on their level, which was fun.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was an experience that surprised me because I hadn't been walking, you know, in a while. My wife and I play a lot of golf together, and I always say that the reason for my taking the cart is for my wife, because she has a bad hip and it's hard for her to get around, but. You know, I grew up, like I think we all did, grew up walking, and, it's like returning to an old friend, actually, because it's a totally different experience, because you really are walking with all the members of your group, and there's no question that, you know, that the golf cart affects that. You will see each other on the tee and on the green, but that's not usually where... You know, the punchline of the joke that you started on the green may be told on the next tee or vice versa, but there's not really a conversation and a meeting of, you know, yeah. of your fellows unless you're walking, I think.
Yeah, I think so much of what makes golf great occurs in the moments in between the shots. And when you're playing the golf cart, you don't have that in the same way. It's not even close.
No, not at all. Not at all. I love that. The things about the day that were that I recall, I wrote down 5 things that I really loved about the day. And the first one was, you know, the preparation. You know, when I got there, they said, "Oh yeah, you're with the group." Yes, they're down at the driving range, and so, you know, as I walked down there, it was exciting to see everybody hitting. And I knew, you know, that I had to get prepared. And so, you know, how I prepare, I don't need to hit many full swing shots anymore, but I do need to chip and pitch and hit some putts and things like that. And it was just, I don't usually do that, you know, when I go play with my wife. You know, we just go there, and I'm a pretty quick starter, so I don't need much to get going, But I knew after I pitched and fatted those first 3 balls that pitching practice was absolutely necessary, and it really paid dividends for me when I went out there. But that it was so exciting right away, and to stand on that first tee and to know that I had to be strategic with my. You know, with my drive, because I looked down at the fairway and I saw, oh, I can't carry that bunker on the right. I better make sure I get this ball on the left side, even if I'm in the rough, just to give me a shot. And you know, so to come out of the box and to have to be thinking and executing a real golf shot instead of, you know, standing up on a golf course and, you know, like the, like a lot of Fazio golf courses, which I like, but I mean, it's a pretty free swing. Yeah. It wasn't a free swing off that first tee.
Yeah, I'm in favor of wide open fairways on the first hole. Give me, I've never played the old course at St. Andrews, but I've been there when my wife and I were there this summer, and hole 1 and 18 are right next to each other. You have a 400-yard wide fairway you can hit to. That's what I like on the first hole.
That's what I need as well.
Yeah. Ty and Jansen, do you have any... thing that stood out to you, anything that made your list of things you remember from the day?
Well, there was one moment that stood out to me, and I guess I'll kind of fast forward to the end of the day. We all went out and got a drink together afterwards, and Andy, I like what you had the group do. There were all of eight of us shared a highlight of the day, our big takeaway or the shot of the day, and so that was really special to hear everybody's highlight, especially because we don't get to play too often, and especially at a nice private club like that. So you knew it was a special day, and so to hear everybody excited about coming off the course and sharing that little moment was cool. But I'll share my moment. It was on the back nine. I think it was number 14. It was the last par five of the day. It was 14 or 15. And I did not hit a great drive. I hooked it left, hit a tree, and I actually hit a quite a nice punch shot through, but that also found myself in the left-hand rough still, and I needed to punch out. And so my objective was to try and punch out to about 150 and then to try and save bogey from there. I figured that would be a pretty good score after a couple tough breaks and a couple sloppy swings. Well, I proceeded to then chunk and push my chip shot or a little punch, and so I'm left with 190 and, with a breeze into and in a pretty small green for a par five. So I got to my ball and I felt a great calmness over myself that I hadn't felt all day. And I said, all right, dude, get it together here. Take a deep breath and let's finish this thing. And so I closed my eyes, which I normally don't do. I like to stand behind the ball and kind of just look at what's in front of me. But I actually closed my eyes, took a deep breath, and I then hit the best four iron of my life to about 8 feet, and we made the putt for par. So that was pretty cool. But I hadn't had a feeling like that on the golf course in quite a while. I feel like I've been fighting my swing over the last month. And that round was the first time that ball striking wise that I felt in control and was able to piece some shots together. But yeah, that was my highlight of the day.
It's pretty critical there, Jansen, since I think you hit every fairway that I saw you tee off on. But
every fairway on the front. The back was a different story, but I was still in some decent spots.
Yeah, there was another par five on the back. I think it was 11 where I hit a five iron about 175, 185 yards into the green, 12 feet. And then I just remember thinking, you know, nice and easy. Don't try to kill this. And it worked out well. And I realized, why have I been trying to kill every shot up to this point? So just relaxing and then letting the club head go. And then seeing the result was great, even though I three-putted for a bogey.
That was actually the same hole, Ty, the 15th.
Right, right.
That was funny.
I remember that because Ty was playing a matte red Volvic ball that looks like a pumpkin out there. And he... That's just his drive on 15 was nowhere near our hole. And
wayward.
So Jansen, Chris, and I were walking up the fairway together, you know, enjoying the camaraderie of walking together. But Ty didn't get to enjoy the stories that time. He had to go way to the right. And Jansen, Chris, and I all hit our balls up. Still, Ty is off somewhere chasing his ball around. We kind of hit up to the green. Then all of a sudden, Ty comes back and he's walking with us. And I notice he's kind of like looking back at me a couple times, and he's got like a little grin on his face. And then I look at the green, and I thought looked like there was a red leaf about 10 feet from the pin. And then I remember that Ty's playing a ball the color of a maple leaf. And I said, Ty, is that your ball? And he smiles. He's like, yeah. Like, for birdie. He disappears and comes back with the greatest shot of the day. That was probably my most memorable moment. Other than hole hole 8 was a par 5, the first par 5 on the front nine, and it was a group of Jansen, Ty, Chris, and I, and we all hit our tee shots, and as we were walking to our balls, I offered everyone a fruit snack, so I brought fruit snacks for my group, and Ty first turned me down because he thought I picked it up off the ground and was offering him trash.
Who else has fruit snacks on the golf course?
I do. I care for my group mates. And we all ate a fruit snack, and everyone was like, oh, man, like that hit the spot. And then it was a short par 5. We all hit our next ball into the only water hazard on the course. I think it was we were just so happy that we just ate a fruit snack that we didn't focus on our round. Jansen even had, like, what, 150 in on a par 5, and you hit it.
I was feeling the driver at that point in time, and I absolutely smashed one, and I had 155 yards into a par 5, and that was the worst iron shot I hit all day into the water.
But Jansen and I both got up and down for par, which was pretty good.
I really enjoyed the round for getting to play with Mike and Tina and Josh, and I know you guys understand this. It's interesting to be out there, you know, with your playing partners, and then to go back inside with yourself as you prepare to hit, you know, your next shot, or in those in between moments. And I think I have familiar conversations in my head, as we've talked about in the past. And I walked around and I was surprised at how much the nervousness and the edginess and the negative thoughts, you know, would come in, because I was playing pretty well. And I thought, you know, it always occurs to me that, you know, hey, this can come apart maybe, you know, at any minute. You can get on a bad roll and lose the round. And to be able to take those thoughts and to turn them into a positive energy, you know, as you get yourself settled over the ball. And I hit some shots out there that were absolutely amazed me. And most of them were with the putter. You know, the pushed up greens, they've got some very dramatic Augusta kind of push-up greens, and I had a shot early in the round where I'd hit a very poor iron on a par 3, I think it was the fourth or the fifth hole, over to the right. Now I'm short-sighted, and I'm looking at a pin that looks like it's sitting on a derby hat, and it's about 10 yards away from me, and my ball is between two chunky looking divots that I know had been hit with a lob wedge. And so I said, there's no way I'm going to do anything but putt this ball. But, you know, how do you know how hard to hit something like that? So to go into your memory bank and to go into your imagination and to come up with some kind of an intuition, to me is a fascinating thing. And I hit that ball and it climbed up that 10 feet of, you know, steep hill and leaked out onto the green, and I had a 7-footer, which I knocked down for par, and I have to say, you know, that's as good a play, you know, as I can make. And it was, and all through the day, I putted the ball, as Jansen said, you know, the collars out there, I love the fast, hard turf that we found out there. I don't know whether they maintain that all year long or whether that's just a fall condition, but so much fun the way they've designed those green complexes to be able to hit that putter, because it's a terrific shot. It's a Lynx kind of a shot that you don't see much here in the Midwest. The guys, when we got to the 16th hole, we saw the maintenance crew, you know, working on the back of the green, or back behind that green, and they were in the process of creating another one of those runoffs that they could put fairway turf on. And to me, that's one of the great changes that we've seen, you know, in recent years with golf courses, where they're taking out the long bluegrass around the greens and putting instead, fairway, so that you've got options, you know, and it's so much fun to be able to use your imagination in different ways. You've always got the flop. You could, you know, bump it into the hill with a, you know, and leak it up to the green, or you could hit that putter. And I love putting out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I look for most in a golf course is, does it give you options on each shot? And I think Westmoreland had more of those around the green than off tee shots or even your second shot in. You know, with the greens, a lot of them are raised up, so there's only really one way to play it. You just have to hit a full high shot in there. The fairways were kind of narrow with these bunkers, so it was hit it, you know, in the fairway, not in a bunker. There wasn't a ton of options off the tee, but yeah, around the greens. And it looked like they were taking out a lot of trees too, which would also help with more options too. So
that's what Chris mentioned. He said from the last time he had played it to now that they had removed quite a few trees. And the spot that Pete was talking about, I think Josh said Josh had played out there quite a bit and said that used to be an entire tree line. You couldn't even see the next hole, which is the par three. And so now that's opened up and it looks fantastic because that area that they're making into fairway runs from the back of 16 green, a nice fairway, a little dip, and then it rises and feeds right into 17 tee box. So it just all looks like one piece that's just kind of molded together, and then you see the tee boxes, and it just makes for a much more open look. It doesn't seem so guarded.
Yeah. Pete, you played in a way Monday that made you overnight decide you're going to play from the opposite side of the golf ball the next day. Not many people have that option in their game, or maybe no one's been that frustrated that they switched the very next day. Maybe I'll try this lefty or righty or vice versa. Can you talk about what your difference was experiencing those two rounds and what you kind of took away from each of them?
Yeah, I think that my left-handed game on Monday, I'd hit so many balls. I was watching, the Bears game the day before, and I was here at the Cube, I was so, you know, frustrated or jacked up with the Bears playing the Patriots and how that all turned about that I ended up pounding balls all afternoon and working on my swing. So now I got to the golf course the next day and my body just felt stiff and I just didn't have a good feel for my swing, and I hit some, you know, I rolled the ball four times, which I can't remember the last time that happened, and I just felt uncoordinated going through the ball. I felt like a lot of people, I grew up with people saying that golf was a top hand game, you know, that if you're a right-handed golfer, that your left hand needed to be dominant. And I've never felt that way. I've always felt that golf was a bottom hand game. And while Bill Melhorn, you know, a great old time pro, I read his book recently, and he said the same thing. And so I've always felt that my left-handed game depended very much on the coordination of my left hand, and I haven't been working very much on it. I used to, a couple of years ago, I used to do a lot of chipping and pitching one-handed, building up that, you know, that coordination. But I feel like that I've lost that, you know, and I've lost that real feel, that kind of athletic intuition that you have when your throwing hand, the bottom hand that's closest to the club head, you know, feels like it can make a throw. And and I feel like I've been, you know, casting it, the hand way too early. And so in any case, I thought after that round that you and I had played, I needed to set a better course for my practice left-handed than what I'd been doing in here, which was really focused a lot on full swing and an idea that I've been pursuing about the plane of the swing instead of like seeking out, well, what's my best way of doing it? You know, I've been working towards a rotational swing, and I've always grown up being a more upright swinger. And I was listening to George Gankus. Ty sent us all a link to one of his podcast that he was on, and so I like what George was saying about, you know, the top of the backswing and, you know, where he likes to see the hands and all that kind of thing. And I've been working on something completely different. I've been working on something more like Ben Hogan, you know, trying to swing, you know, and pinch the kind of the left arm against the side, I should say the trail arm. And it's just been, I don't know that practice is really, you know, it's just an idea that I thought was like, oh, this is a better way to swing. Well, it's a different way to swing, and I'm not sure that it's a better way to swing for me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go back to righty. And righty's been doing something of the same thing. I mean, the same swing changes. I started to pursue right-handed, you know, back in 2010. And, you know, it was a major swing change, major change of thought for me. And you know, in recent years, I've started to feel more intuitive about that. But still, it's something that I have to put together deliberately all the time, because the pattern of swinging that I had for 30 years, ever since I got into the golf business, has been different from that. But I'm always been a tinkerer and like to pursue ideas that might be better than the ideas I've got. And so sometimes that takes me into places that I don't, my game doesn't prosper. I always learn something from it, but at any rate, I guess the long and the short of it, Andy, is that I had a sense from our round that I needed to change my practice, and when I went back to right-handed, you know, my body has been rested. You know, going back and forth right to left-handed is I think a way healthier way for me to physically keep myself out of injury.
And the more I've practiced and learned in this game, the more I've realized that there is no textbook way to do it. You know, my dad handed me Ben Hogan's book, Five Lessons, very early on and said, this is the Bible, follow this, you know, whatever you do, look back this for reference. But Gankus and No Laying Up podcast, shout out to those guys. But on that podcast talks about he doesn't mind the flying elbow. And, you know, I'd be interested to see Jansen's perspective and other teachers, actual PGA professionals' opinions, because that's not what you usually hear. But, you know, look at some of his students like Matthew Wolf and people like that who are just killing it now in college with weird actions. It's an interesting theory.
Yeah, and you could even debate that, you know, calling it weird is almost an insult to them, because it's not really weird. It's just a different way of doing it, and they do it a phenomenal job of doing what they're doing. Now you look at Matt Wolf; he's undefeated this year. I'm not sure what the entire backstory is on that, but I know he just can't stop winning, so that's a good thing, right? and he has one of the most interesting swings, probably since Furyk.
Right.
It looks kind of similar to Furyk in some ways, but he understands the mechanics of the swing and his sequencing, and he has ownership of his swing, which I think is important. And he's able to hit any kind of shot you ask him to hit, and he's certainly tough as nails up in the head too. He's a competitor, so it's cool to see. You know, one thing that I felt during our round at Westmoreland, you know, not playing outside, we're starting to transition coming inside. And that was my first round outside in about a month. I mean, I had opportunities to play outside the last month, but just didn't get around to it. Quite frankly, I was kind of tired of playing the course over and over again up at Lake Bluff, just because I was there all summer. But it, you know, with my practice recently, I've been bashing balls on the TrackMan a lot, which I've learned a great amount. But understanding what does my process look like of what I need to work on, and what are the two numbers that or three numbers that I need to work on, and what's the plan to get those to change, was really eye opening to me, because I played Canal Shores the week before, and I really hit the ball terribly. My short game was great because I put some good time into that. But I was outside and I was uncomfortable. I said, well, maybe I'm just making these changes too quickly, and I'm not going about it the right way, especially if I'm trying to want to go play outside still. I have to get my mindset right. And as Pete said, I have to organize my practice to allow me to enjoy my myself out there. And so when I went out to Westmoreland, I came to the cube in the morning just to get loosened up because I didn't want to hit too many balls before the round out there. And I don't like saying going back to my old swing or going back to old thing, but I felt comfortable with what I was working on that day, and I don't know what clicked, but I just felt comfortable with committing myself to a couple of thoughts. And it really just came together, which was nice. And it's hard to explain that sometimes, what makes you make those decisions in your practice and everything. But I think it's a pretty mature thing to do, to be able to make a change on the fly, especially Pete, your example is awesome of saying, hey, I'm going to put lefty. I love how you call it lefty and righty. I'm going to put lefty in timeout and righty. Come on, let's do this thing. For me to go out there at Westmoreland and swing more freely and be confident and have trust in myself was pretty awesome for me to be able to do and be able to structure my practice the days leading up to it to get prepared for that. So
since I've started coaching and teaching more, it's been a struggle trying to play golf in the midst of that. If you've been teaching kids how to play golf for 5 days out of the week, and then you go play on a Friday afternoon and you have that first, greenside pitch shot, it's so easy to I naturally just like tell myself what I would have told, what I've been telling the kids all day. And that of course leads to just a terrible shot because I don't know, you're overthinking it, you're overanalyzing it. And the same thing happened to me at Westmoreland. I've been working on hitting drives, and I still have all these driver swing thoughts in my head. And the same thing happened Monday and Tuesday to me. Hit terrible drives for the first 7 holes, and then I finally just, the driver stays in the bag, and I hit 3-wood, which I can hit plenty far, but it still takes me like 8 holes to get to that place both days. How do you guys who teach and have been teaching a lot make that transition to just like from teaching to playing?
Well, I have found, especially later in life, that I actually channel some of my students so that I'll go out there and actually start to have my own experience of the miseries that they go through. And so I feel like I'm, an authority in some ways on that. I can remember having a round up at... years ago in a tournament round where one of my students had been experiencing anxiety on the course. And I didn't even know what that was like until the next day I went out and played in a tournament, and all of a sudden I was Bob. and I had to call on everything I knew about, mind control and meditation to get myself out of it. I think you really do have to practice mindset and perspective, just like you're practicing anything else. I think I probably told you the story that one of the great lessons I ever got in golf, and I was in the midst of restudying Hogan's five modern fundamentals, five lessons, and I was practicing in a park near my house called Mellis Park. It's in Arlington Heights, and there are no pins and greens, but there were garbage cans and outhouses and soccer goals and things like that. So I've got a pitching wedge in my hand, and it's buried in 2 or 3 inches of bluegrass, and I'm looking at the corner of the goal, and I'm about 60 yards away, and so I channeled Tim Galway's inner game, and I just only thought about the corner of the goalpost, and just drew it back and swung with no thought, and sent the ball and looked up and in amazement as the ball headed right towards the corner, and with a big loud crack, it ricocheted off of it, and the next sound I heard was a voice in my head saying, "Yeah. But did you swing right?" And I thought, I sat down on the ground right there, and I thought, what's happened to me? You know, why would I even ask that question? But it ends up, you know, that what I came away with from sort of that Moses trip up to the mountain was that both mindsets are necessary. It's not one's right and the other's wrong. I mean, if you only think about the target and you never check in on your swing, you don't know what's going on with it. You know, but if you're always playing golf by operating the levers in your body instead of reacting athletically to the target and to the trajectory and to the curve and to whatever it is that you want to create, then you're not going to be much of a golfer either. And so I think that once I learned that, it gave me permission to go back and forth. And it also set my path to know that, yeah, you got to practice shifting mm-hmm. gears. So I make that a part of my my practice, that I don't get too lost in mechanical thoughts, that I always have kind of a, you know, let's check back in with that laser connection, mm-hmm. you know, with the target and see what we can do.
Yeah. Friend of the golf practice, Dan Utley, has told us he recommends having swing thoughts during your putting, during your swing, having actual things he's thinking on, whether it's how your shoulders move, how your wrists move. And he's taught lots of tour players using that method. But also Bob Rotella, who has lots of good books out there and is more of a mental game coach, who's also worked with tour players, teaches the opposite and says he doesn't want his students to have any swing thoughts and to only kind of see a target and react to the target. Do you have any swing thoughts out there? Which philosophy do you adhere to?
Well, Pete just got me thinking with what he was just saying there a minute ago, and I think that's what he was saying is I was definitely too focused on the mechanics of what I was trying to do in my swing personally. And when I went out and played the par 3 course, you know, obviously I was just trying to force it and probably worried too much about hitting those positions to get a result. And neither of them were happening. So obviously the result wasn't happening. And then as I went to the track, man, and I trusted the process that I was going through and I trusted those positions and I didn't really worry about the aesthetics of it or how it looked or really even how it felt, but just trusted that if I just swung that I grooved this thing enough that I would get there. Well, then sure enough, I checked back in on video and it actually looked pretty good. And I was doing what I was trying to work on, but I just wasn't worried about perfecting it. And then I was able to be much more free, much more loose, and actually hit the shots that I know I can hit. And so that's a great way to balance it, I think, is, yeah, you got to get really technical and mechanical, but at the same time, you just got to let loose and trust yourself that you will hit those positions. And it also reminded me of a student I was working with this past weekend, hit some really, really great shots this weekend. I was super impressed with his numbers, the ball flight, just the overall motion of the swing. He's made some great progress the last month. And he hit just a beautiful ball. And he's funny with his body language. He might hit one perfect, but he's going to finish with one hand. And he looks at me and he goes, "Was that good?" And I said, "Well, you tell me." I'm like, "Hell yeah, it was good. You know, it was perfect. You hit it right where we wanted to. You swung through your station nicely." And he goes, "Well, yeah, I think it was pretty good." Well, I said, "I agree." And he goes, "But did it look good?" And I said, "Well, I think it looks pretty good if the result happened, right? Like, yes, both of those things mashed up well. But obviously he was a little confused of what he needs to focus on. You know, he was too worried about, I think he's too worried about how it looks. You know, obviously I think golfers are trying to ultimately perfect the look of it. They want to have a good looking tour swing and have an awesome ball flight end result, right? They want to have those two. But it's often the case that you can only have one at a time, or bring your focus to only one of them.
Yeah, and as far as me, that's how I feel. I feel like I hit the ball best when I have one swing thought or maybe two. And so as someone who doesn't play golf in groups of four that often, I get out there and get a little bit nervous, even with you guys, and I've got a million thoughts going through my head suddenly. And so if I can somehow, it usually takes a few holes, pare that down to one thought, two thoughts max, that's when I find I hit the ball best.
Cool. Yeah. Whenever I have swing thoughts, I feel like they are an evidence that I don't trust my swing and that I'm trying to swing with logic and ideas and overcorrecting things, and I never do well. So I should stop doing that. But it's hard to do. I don't know. No other way to say it. Of somehow takes a while to figure that out.
One of the things that I've used over the years, and now I've started referring to it as the processor, and that is to instead of making individual practice swings, to swing the club to and fro, and to actually build the swing through that. I usually let it go back and forth three cycles, and I started noticing it years ago. Whenever I'd watch one of my students or just any player that I was playing with make two swings back and forth, the second swing always looked better than the first. It was looser, more rhythmic, more symmetrical. And then I started to think, gosh, if you let that go back and forth one more time, you may have a pretty good thought. And so so that's what I use. I'll take any swing thought, any particular thought that I want to work on, whether that's I want to feel my takeaway a little different, or I want to feel the top of the backswing or transition move or whatever it is, I'll just blend it into that so that the verbalizations now become a nonverbal body demonstration, and that pattern I find to be very compelling. If now what I noticed the other day at when we played at Westmoreland is that on that one blind hole, the seventh hole, that may have been the best shot that I hit all day. It wasn't the longest drive, but it was a drive that I hit in the face of great uncertainty because, as we said, it was blind. And I piped it straight down the middle of the fairway. And what I did was I just went from this rhythmic to and fro processing to a waggle, and then just went right away from it and knocked it, you know, with an effort that I would say on a scale of 1 to 10 was, I don't know, 6.5. And I realized that I've been standing over the ball. I've been settling over the ball too long. And instead of being able to get my swing going and then transitioning in a flow that has tautness but not tension and effort, that's what I walked away from the golf course with, is that, oh, gee, I need more of that. And like I like to say, the processors, that's how we make the smoothies.
That is good.
I'm still trying to think about what that means.
Food processor.
That's how you mean.
It's okay. Like the blender. You put all the ingredients in.
I'm just trying to figure out what that has to do with hole 7 at Westmoreland, but I'm sorry. Maybe you can explain it to me after the podcast. Guys, any other last reflections on the day?
Just as far as what we were working on and, you know, going into that round and what we take away from it and work on afterwards. I was having fun in our indoor facility, the Cube, the week before, practicing like 20 yards pit shots with 9-iron and 8-iron and just seeing the different trajectories, and actually got to use that on the course. So that was fun and really tying practice into play, which I liked. And so moving forward, I need to work on that and a million other things, but it's always fun to practice in the Cube.
Yeah, I would just have to say that I'm excited to continue to work on my swing project, and know that the direction that I am heading is a good direction, because I was able to kind of prove that, I guess, in a sense. And I'm a little bit sad that we can't get out and play more because that was such a fun day.
It's a cold world here. And entering into the darkness of November, December, January, February.
Yeah. But I think as a staff, those outings always bring out the best in us and bring us closer together. And I think we're all pretty fired up for this winter from our experiences being outside and working on our own games that we can bring that ultimately back to our students and share those lessons. And hopefully they listen to this and they can take something away from it. And we can use our experiences to help our students this winter.
I mean, golf is fun, man. Yes. I don't know what you guys think, but I think it's fun.
It's really fun.
All right. One last question, Pete. When you dream, do you swing right-handed or left-handed in your dreams?
Well, you know, I really do. I use the twilight, period where you're just starting to fall off or you're just starting to wake up. I definitely use that, and I go back and forth. I mean, I really flip back and forth because I find that like the great movement trainer Feldenkrais said, you know, your one side teaches your other side. He used to exercise people and only exercise one side of the body. And what he found was that that the brain, you know, transmitted that to the other side. Well, I've gotten to the point right now where, I can swing one swing in my mind one way and one swing the other way. And I'm glad you asked the question because it's, it's an interesting phenomenon. And I definitely go to, if I want to feel, real flow through the ball, I start left or right-handed, I should say, because that's the side that I'm better on. And that's, one thing that I was working on the other day at Westmoreland was the notion of, being able to take the club to a place at the top of the backswing and then move the body without having to put so much effort in the arms. I got such a great feeling, but I couldn't keep from making effort with my arms as the swing, as the game went on. Now, I was in such a good flow that I could, I could hit the balls with that extra rhythm, but I realized, that I was being kind of drawn into something that I think most of my students would think, oh, that swing at the end of the round, that's my best swing. But in truth, once you get into a rhythm, you can sometimes accommodate a swing or that's too hard and too effortful. And the mistake is to walk away from the course thinking, oh, that's my swing. That's what I'm going to start with next time. Instead of, your better angels and let that increased effort happen as you find it during the round. So anyway, I'm sorry I didn't really end by answering your question, but
you sort of did. Do you remember your dreams? No, I'm talking about like you're asleep. What? And you're like playing Augusta with Barack Obama
and Tiger Woods.
What handed are you swinging with?
Yeah, I'm swinging right-handed.
Right-handed. Okay, so you're subconscious. No, it's right-handed. Okay, thank you very much. Well, guys, thanks for being here. It's been. And almost as nice as a nice round of golf outside together, but this will have to do.
Pleasure to be
in our back closet here. Listeners, thank you for listening. You can find the golf practice on Instagram at the.golf.practice. Jansen also has an Instagram. Would you share it with us?
TGP Golf Coach Jansen.
TGP Golf Coach Jansen. I am Andy Hayes Golf. And Ty, do you have Instagram? Maybe.
No.
It's not very. All right. Well, I'll just cut
I help
out.
Run TGP Golf's.
All right. That's good
Instagram.
Enough. If you have a question for Ty, you can go through the golf practices Instagram. And Pete, we're still teaching what Instagram is. But that's okay. All right. I'm Ty.
Clean contact. I hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment. The moment defines you.
Well, here it comes. Oh my goodness.
Harris.